From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when President Donald Trump decided to authorize a strike against Iranian leader Qasem Soleimani. Trump did not seek approval from Congress. He did not share details of the strike in advance with top congressional leaders. He simply decided to launch the strike, and it was done. Author Sarah Burns did not know these events would unfold just as her new book was coming out, but she is perhaps not surprised either. Burns is the author of The Politics of War Powers, The Theory and History of Presidential Unilateralism. She's a professor of political science at RIT, and her book could give us another opening connection, 1748, when a man who is now known simply as Montesquieu anonymously published The Spirit of Law. The book had strong influence on the founding fathers of the United States. So what would Montesquieu say about the trajectory of the United States today, particularly as it compares to the Roman Empire? It's not hard to find comparisons to Rome, but Burns' book is the most thorough, careful work of comparative scholarship that I've come across on that subject. She takes us through the history of our country and the approach to war powers and how it has changed. She draws upon Montesquieu's ideas about the necessary tension between Congress and the president. And she concludes that today the president has concentrated an enormous amount of power. So how far out of balance have we fallen? Are we inexorably on the path of Rome? To Burns' credit, she doesn't simplify an answer to that question, but she's concerned, clearly. In writing for Esquire this week, Jack Holmes says, quote, "In every arena, the president has set out to defy the notion that Congress is a co-equal branch of government with enumerated powers he cannot simply choose to ignore. Apparently, he can just ignore Congress," end quote. Vice President Mike Pence has been sent out to explain that presidents can order military strikes without explaining why. They just have to tell the public that there is valid intelligence. It's just too sensitive to share it. No congressional approval necessary. This hour, let's talk about war powers, who has them, and what that means for this American experiment. My guest is Sarah Burns, the author of The Politics of War Powers and a professor of political science at RIT. Welcome and congratulations on this book.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I said, you know, you've been working on this for years. You had no idea that what's going on in Iran would be happening. It's an illustration of maybe some of the concerns that might animate the book, but you probably had some kind of a guess that somewhere there would be unilateral action happening, given the recent decades of history.
Yes, it's very true that you see unilateral actions happening all the way back to really FDR as the sort of starting point or big starting point. Prior to that, you still had Congress really trying to constrain executives. And even with FDR, even though he was a charismatic and wonderful leader that was beloved in the country, you still see Congress really holding him back from helping the British in the Second World War, from, you know, doing anything other than complete neutrality. And it's only really with Pearl Harbor that you see Congress kind of ceding its power to the presidency, never to really pick it up again afterwards.
And listeners, as we work through the history of this country and the history of war powers, I will say at the outset here, Professor Burns is not here in any sort of partisan fashion. We'll talk about what's going on in Iran, but she also has, I think, a fair and sober lens of what the Obama presidency brought. We'll talk about a lot of that. But before we even get there, let's rewind a little bit, because your book had that great quality that that my favorite books have, which is I'll read a chapter or even a paragraph and I'll go, well, I'm jumping back on the internet to learn more about this separate subject. I want to dive into this. So for those who've heard the name Montesquieu but don't know much about Montesquieu, tell us who that was.
Yeah, so his full name is Charles-Louis de Secondat, Baron de la Brède de Montesquieu, which is partially why people tend to just call him Montesquieu. And he was a French theorist who worked basically at the beginning of the modern period where we see states emerging in Europe. And what he did was he kind of looked around himself at the time and said, you know, all these states with all these kings and queens have immense armies that they're sending all over the world to try and, you know, find new land in at the time in the Americas and, you know, trade with India and some Asian countries. And he was saying, you know, we're using these powers incorrectly, right? What they should be doing is just trying to focus on commerce rather than trying to kill each other or gain, you know, a little bit of territory here or a little bit of territory there. And so what he then does is attempt, very similar to Aristotle, if that helps anyone, he attempts to create an understanding about how states should interact with each other and how constitutions should be formed to combine universal principles like the separation of powers with the unique qualities of a given people or a given culture. And so he, unlike a lot of other theorists, tries to balance those two things together. And one of the things we see in U.S. foreign policy and a variety of European foreign policies previously is an attempt to kind of take their institutions and then impose them very directly on another culture or another society. And then they sort of marvel at the fact that the society isn't greeting them as liberators. And so what Montesquieu tries to do is map out why that is, why it is that we're so connected to our culture, why we don't want to just adopt the institutions of another culture, and, you know, the friction that can occur when you have these two interactions.
You could have chosen a lot of different historians, writers, philosophers to sort of draw upon and to kind of hang some of the book's tenets on, and you chose Montesquieu. Other writers and historians and political scientists have chosen others. Why did you choose Montesquieu?
I think he does the best job of what I was saying there, which is the focus on universal principles with the deep understanding that you cannot override someone's culture. And change can't happen overnight. Change can't happen by imposition. It really does, in order for it to feel like positive change, it has to come slowly. It has to come to a certain extent from within. And anytime you try and force it or push it too far, that's going to cause significant backlash, right? And we can see that in big and small instances.
Do you think then Montesquieu would have been surprised that in 2003, as Rumsfeld predicted, we were greeted as liberators, given a bunch of roses, and there was no real strife in Iraq following that?
Yes, I think it's exactly the kind of thing that he could have predicted, that this is not, you know, an easy transition.
Perhaps Rumsfeld didn't read Montesquieu.
I don't think he did, no. I think there was a lack of knowledge of that particular historical figure amongst a lot of people in many administrations.
Well, the reason I'm being flippant is because you know, this is a philosopher whose work dating back to, you know, the 1700s, those themes really do hold up over time. That's one of the lessons of history, which is why it is perhaps surprising to see these large operations launched without a very good grasp on the likely cultural battles you're going to face beyond just sort of, quote, liberating a people. That oversimplification is dangerous, and we've known that. I mean, Montesquieu knew it. We just had to read and think a little bit here. We'll get back to that in a moment here. Our guest, Sarah Burns, if you want to join the program, listeners, it's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. So for me, I think the really instructive aspects of the book are, there's two big themes for me as a reader. Number one is just understanding what a properly balanced set of war powers would look like in an ideal world, and then how it looks, you know, sort of comparatively to reality now, and then understanding what that means for the possible trajectory of an entire sort of political experiment, which Rome was, which the United States is. So a lot of people draw this lesson. Why did Rome fall? Are we the next Rome, et cetera? And you take a look at that. Montesquieu wrote about that. So when you're, you know, at dinner parties and people are saying, oh, you're a political scientist, so why did Rome fall? What's the short version you give them?
Oh, that's a very good question. And I'm going to do the professor thing and say what a good question that was, so I can think for a moment. I think the short answer would be that they were able to rise for a long time because they always had someone to compete against. And once you see Rome having no competitors and no one to really push against and fight against, that's when you start seeing this turn towards imperialism. Because they didn't have a capacity to hold themselves in, right? And so one of the big differences then you would see between Rome or the Roman method was that they had to, in order to support their economy, they had to constantly expand. Because what they would do is they would pay their soldiers by saying, all right, we're going to give you a land in Gaul, or we're going to give you land in current day Turkey. And so as you get a larger and larger army, you have to keep on going farther and farther out. Once you then get these very powerful generals that have been far flung from Rome for, you know, 10, 15 years, and they have these very, very loyal soldiers under their command, that's when you start getting the ambitious general saying, maybe I should be in control of Rome, and maybe I should be the one who's running everything. And, you know, all that talk about liberty and virtue, you know, that's not nearly as important as the powerful, you know, military might that I bring that, you know, gives Rome its salience in the world. So I think that that's the big issue, is that once Rome beat Carthage and didn't have anyone else to really fight, you just see them kind of corrupting their morals and going farther and farther afield and not being able to pull themselves back in.
And so me not at all being a scholar on Roman history, just sort of an amateur consumer, you hear a lot about the downfall of Caesar and the hubris and sort of blame in that direction. And you read about Caesar's downfall, which might have been his arrogance and the way he mocked the Senate. You know, and mm-hmm. he certainly had the power. The Senate really didn't. If he placated their ego, could he have survived? Would history have been different if he hadn't been so intent to sort of mock? And because if the Senate truly is sort of feckless and the executive has the power, as Caesar did, he could have at least propped them up and made them feel sort of important, or at least said, well, look, you've got the more money than the proletariat. But do you think by placating egos, things could have turned out differently there?
I think that it would have been very hard for Caesar to really placate them, because they wanted perhaps what you would call like real power rather than the sort of showy power that he was potentially going to offer them. Mm-hmm. On top of that, I think part of Caesar's personality made that impossible for him to do, because he really wanted to have all of the power so concentrated in him. So very similar to Louis XIV, right, who said, I am the sun and everything revolves around me. So if Caesar had a slightly different, less megalomaniacal personality, you might have been able to see some balance then, right? Which would have preserved the institutions a little bit more, or perhaps for a little bit longer. How much longer after that, or after Caesar, that they would have been preserved is an open question.
But it seems, as you write, that that path had largely been sort of cemented, Caesar or not, that at that point in Roman history, and that's when I start thinking about, well, where are we then? And how do we make these kinds of comparisons? But the main point there is Rome did not fall overnight.
Right. Yeah. You know, decades. It wasn't, you know, one or two very astute leaders. It was a few leaders all doing things to attempt to save the Republic, or to attempt to keep the Republic together. And that eventually causing the rise of someone like Caesar, right? Because of these generals being very far flung, and a personality like Caesar's, who just like desperately needs the attention and love and affection of all the people.
I want to quote from your book now, because this is where I think critics of this comparison will try to push back a little bit. I think critics of the comparison to Rome might say something like this, that Rome did not seek some altruistic goal of helping other populations achieve freedom. You know, Rome seeked to expand its own power and influence for power's sake. And in contrast, the U.S. has used its power to try to export freedom, however clumsily, but with more of an altruistic sort of a goal here. Again, I'm thinking of what the critics might say. So here's what you write in your chapter on the World Wars. You write, quote, as the leader of the Allied forces, the United States moved into its new role as the world police, in quotes there with world police, with the Navy patrolling international waters, ensuring the safe passage of commercial trade and passenger ships. The military kept troops deployed in a variety of countries in both Europe and Asia. The global currency changed from the British pound to the U.S. dollar. It was clear at this point that the United States had completed its transformation from British colonies to superpower. And with this change came a new institutional consensus between the president in Congress. First of all, what was that consensus?
The new institutional consensus was that presidents would take the lead very clearly and have a great deal of unilateral control. And this was in part in order to have the flexibility that you would need in order to deal with the new and very complicated world that they were suddenly, as they saw themselves, in charge of. And so once you see yourself as in charge of this whole world, you want a very powerful executive that has the agility to address, you know, trading issues in the Pacific and, you know, a civil war in Latin America very, very effectively and very, very quickly. And so that then meant that Congress had to say, all right, well, what are we going to do with our powers? How are we going to hold this person accountable? And their decision was essentially to say, we're going to let you, for the most part, initiate activities, and then after the fact, we're going to hold you accountable. So we'll have hearings and ensure that things are going in the right direction, but we really won't be co-equal when it comes to deciding how it is to conduct our foreign policy.
And so this is, again, where the critics might say, sure, you can pick this hinge point in American history as the understanding between Congress and the executive that, sure, there's going to be political differences, et cetera, but there's kind of this tacit understanding that, well, you need, as you say, the agility to respond, and there's going to be more concentrated power, and that balance is going to shift a little. But the reason the balance is shifting is for this altruistic goal that we want to be able to respond to human rights crises and the needs of foreign populations who want democracy, as opposed to just expanding empire the way the Romans did and the way Montesquieu might say, well, that... I think Montesquieu gets a lot of credit for despotism, the notion of despotism, and mm-hmm. he might say Rome is much more guilty of that than the United States. So again, the critics might say that's where the parallel breaks down. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, I understand that. I'm sympathetic to that criticism because there's an idea that the U.S. has never, for the most part, sought to expand beyond North America. So you can make the case that, well, we were isolationists until the turn of the 20th century. You would have to kind of ignore the fact that we took a bunch of Mexico from Mexico and took a bunch of France from France. But all the same, you can make that case. Once you get into the 20th century and the U.S. kind of sees itself, though, as a new imperial power, it really is taking the cloak of the European understanding. And the problem also that the U.S. has is, even if they are, for the most part, and we already see this very clearly in World War I, Woodrow Wilson says very definitively, we are not for empire, we're not expanding our lands, we're not, you know, going to hold you accountable, we are fighting for civilization. So as long as the U.S. can actually stay with those high-level goals, you can claim that they're different than Rome. The difficulty is, if you had a history in Latin America, Africa, Asia, so most parts of the world with Europeans, when the U.S. comes in and says, we're here to help you be self-determined, we're here to help you be free, this is how you have to be free, this is what you want to be when you're self-determined, you can't be communist, you can't, you know, have all these other tendencies, it doesn't look that way to native populations or populations outside of the United States. So the difficulty for the United States is towing that line between actually being helpful, actually helping people self-determine, and then having the willingness and capacity to step back when they decide, as the Vietnamese did, for example, to become communist rather than to become a liberal democracy. And that's something that the U.S. has had trouble with. So when they tip away from you can be self-determined towards you have to be self-determined the way we tell you to be, that's when our foreign policy goes awry.
Okay. And not to be naive here, for listeners who keep hearing me use the word altruism, I'm sort of making kind of a caricatured view of what critics might say, this comparison of Rome to the United States, because I understand that there's one thing to have geographical, physical lands, but there's also the influence of commerce, the influence, spreading influence abroad is not just acquiring land. And I understand that a lot of what the United States has done regarding its military and regarding its operations overseas, covert and not, is in regards to control. It's in regards to power and influence. So is there a modern parallel that even if we're not expanding the geographical territory the way Rome did, the expansion of influence is also perhaps a precarious or dangerous thing for empire to do?
So the big difference would be that under Roman rule, you had to adhere to Roman law. And under Roman rule, if you tried to strike out against what they were doing or try and do something they didn't like, they would subtly or very aggressively undermine your leaders, kill your leaders, instigate civil wars. So you were really under the thumb of the Romans once you were in the Roman Empire. That's not true for the United States. There are a lot of times when the United States, you know, tries something or tries to push for democratization or tries to push for economic openness and is rebuffed and accepts that as a fact. So those are important differences between the two.
Okay. And again, thinking about that hinge point in history coming with the world wars and this notion of Congress and the executive viewing that balance differently, given what had happened in the world wars and given the idea that in a changing world, the executive of the United States needed to have more power, more unilateral power, more agility to respond. Is there a logic there? Or is that a precarious way to view the evolution of executive power? And frankly, I'm going to ask you a totally unfair question. What do you think Montesquieu would say about it?
I think Montesquieu would say that there is a natural I think Montesquieu would say that there's a natural way in which institutions kind of balance out over time. So as regimes get older, what you tend to see is the concentration of power into one set of hands. That doesn't necessarily mean the power into the hands of the executive, but it can mean that one of the two branches or one of the three branches kind of pulls as much power into their hands as possible. And I think that there was a logic to the consensus insofar as it seemed like a perilously dangerous world. So by the time we get to 1950, right, this is a few years after the end of World War II, where the U.S. is kind of riding this high of being a virtuous, you know, a bringer of peace to the world and a destroyer of fascism to the world. By 1950, the early part of 1950, the Soviets had nuclear weapons, and the Soviets were very aggressively wandering around the world, gobbling up places and saying, you're now Soviets, you're now part of the Soviet Empire, and you're going to be communist. So it's a fairly understandable and natural reaction that the Americans would then say, we need to combat this with everything we have. And so I'm perhaps more sympathetic than I should be to Congresses during the Cold War who seem to think, you know, we have to let presidents run all of this so that we have a point person who really is engaged with the Russians because they were always in very, very good communication and really has a very clear understanding about what they're doing, how they're doing it, and how we should respond. Because it's very true that it's awfully difficult to get 535 people to agree on anything. So it's understandable that members of Congress would say, you know, we'll let the president take over. It's also true that the very act of legislating and compromising and deliberating is a very difficult and long-term task. And so if conversely you say to members of Congress, why don't you focus on constituency services, right? We have this huge growing bureaucracy after the Second World War because of the New Deal. And, you know, people don't know how to get their Social Security. And so, you know, why don't you help them? And why don't you focus on then getting reelected and making sure the people in the country are happy and focus on domestic issues? And so that was a way for Congress to continue to have a job with the president taking much more of a centralized role in the decision making around foreign policy.
And to be clear, in the intervening decades, this dynamic hasn't really been different between Republicans and Democrats in leadership, has it?
That's the very shocking thing that I found, especially I wrote an article, and it's a bit of it in the book, about how it is that executive lawyers have interpreted executive power in the Clinton and Obama administrations. Because those are two administrations where, as we saw in the Obama administration, you know, there's the fear of another 9/11 and the fear of, you know, big terrorist attack had really dissipated by that point. And for Clinton, you know, there was this heady sense that we were the only superpower, there were no other threats left. So you would think in both of those instances, it would be a time for the executive to kind of give over some of its powers back to Congress, or alternatively for Congress to assertively say to the presidency, we want some more of our foreign policy powers back. But instead, we see both Clinton and Obama saying, we have this very, very broad understanding about executive power, and we're going to assert it. And in turn, you have like aggressive Republican Congresses saying, okay, we accept that. We don't like it. We'll talk on the Sunday shows about it, but we aren't going to stop you with legislation.
So again, if that sounds cartoonish to listeners, what the professor is really saying is that's effectively the response of Congress. They can claim to not like it or malign the president and the press, but the actual actions taken by Congress did not reflect a balance of power or an attempt to rebalance power.
Yeah, it's to me a very, very surprising thing that even by the 90s and, you know, you can... Even by the 90s and the Obama administration, you don't see Congress kind of reasserting its role in the realm of foreign policy. And you don't have presidents who say, you know, I should really make this branch a co-equal branch. So neither branches are approaching each other for these things. And instead, you have presidents saying, I have all of these powers, and Congress making speeches about the fact that they are a co-equal branch. They deserve to have these powers, but then not actually passing legislation to try and reassert them.
Well, I think that, to be clear, is the question listeners may have. And take Libya, for example, which seems to be the most forgotten of recent foreign affairs during the Obama administration. If Congress was going to be acting in a way that you're describing beyond just talking on the Sunday shows, you're talking about passing legislation. Listeners may be wondering, what are they supposed to do, impeach him? I don't know. What are the actions of a Congress that is seeking to truly act in the balance that was more in mind at this country's founding vis-a-vis where it's gone in the last century?
The quicker action or the quicker response would be that they have to simply pass legislation either supporting what it is the president's doing or alternatively saying, you are no longer allowed to use the funds that we have given to you for this action. The other thing they could do that's more of a long-term solution is what Congress was attempting to do at the end of 2019, where Congress had a clause in the Defense Appropriations Act saying that Trump wasn't allowed to use any of the money for any engagement with Iran. So that's a way for them to preempt any kind of action with the presidency. The things that they can do once a president has acted is they can invoke the War Powers Resolution. They tried to do that over the summer with Trump in Yemen and say that they wanted the U.S. to withdraw. It's a bit confusing. So the Saudis are supporting one of the sides in Yemen in the civil war, and we are supporting the Saudis. And so Congress wanted us to stop supporting the Saudis, supporting the Yemeni civil war. And that didn't quite work. But those are the three different ways that they could possibly stop the presidency.
Is your book a prescription for rebalancing war powers?
I think it's more of a diagnostic and a demonstration of what the problem is and demonstrating how long the problem has been around. And part of the reason why I have a whole chapter on the 90s, because most of the other book focuses on bigger wars. But in the 90s, you had this potential opportunity for Congress to really reassert itself and engage in what Edward Corwin called the invitation to struggle, right? The invitation to struggle over the direction of foreign policy. And instead, what you see is Congress still doing what I was saying before, which is just sitting on the sidelines and complaining about what it is that presidents are doing without really being able to pass anything or really being able to get collective action. Because by the 90s, what you see is partisanship had taken over so significantly that Democrats were basically, except for very left of center Democrats, but Democrats were basically going to go along with their president and Republicans are going to condemn them. And then convert, you have the flip where Republicans are basically going to support the president when it's a Republican president and vice versa. So what you have there is a total imbalance of the institutional structure because you're supposed to have a legislative branch that guards its powers, right? This is James Madison, Federalist 51, saying ambition must be made to counteract ambition. So they weren't waiting for or looking for virtue from the people who were going to be in Congress or the presidency. They were just expecting them to be, you know, jealously guarding their powers against the other branches. So once you have partisanship sort of throwing that all off, you can't guard your powers as a branch. You have to guard your powers as a party. And so that's essentially the diagnosis that I've come to.
Okay. So in other words, at the founding, partisanship's always been around. It has always been heated. But this idea of the war powers and how they are sort of understood in the earlier days, if there was going to be team sports in politics, the healthier team sports is legislative versus the executive as opposed to just party versus party.
Exactly, yes. Mm-hmm.
And the consequence now is you have an inept and sort of gutted legislative branch that cannot check or doesn't seek to check the executive, no matter who's in power now.
Correct. I would say that Democrats in the realm of war are more inclined to check the executive than Republicans, but Republicans are disinclined to check their own president to such a degree that we see people in Congress even saying, we don't have the power to stop him from acting. We shouldn't be stopping him from acting. Trump should be allowed to carry out this policy on his own without our input.
If Democrats are complaining about that today, are they at least partially to blame given the lack of action in previous presidencies, including Democrats like Clinton and Obama?
I think it would be hard for the Democrats to simply throw stones at the Republicans, and I don't think that it would be fair to blame either party exclusively or wholly, because I would say it's more just legislators in general. You could potentially, I guess, get them all off the hook if you said, well, their incentive structure has been so changed by election strategies and things like that in the late 20th century that they didn't have much choice but to shift the way that they interacted with the executive branch. But that seems to me to be a cop-out. It really does feel like their constitutional duties are their constitutional duties, and they're not performing them.
The book is called The Politics of War Powers by Sarah Burns. She's our guest. She's a professor of political science at RIT. We're on a really good streak of books lately, by the way. And listeners know we do a lot of books on this program. Usually you can tell if the host really liked it or not. And this is a really readable, digestible, and frankly vital piece of work and scholarship. So we appreciate that. And Sarah's going to take some of your calls after our only break. We're also, yes, going to talk about Iran and more with Sarah Burns next. Coming up in our second hour, what is the responsibility of higher learning institutions when it comes to dealing with diversity, promoting diversity, understanding cultural differences, and bridging divides? Well, Syracuse University joins a list of institutions that have established special committees reviewing and developing diversity and inclusion policies on campus. What does that really mean? We explore it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Before your feedback, which I think some of our listeners want to focus on what's going on in Iran, I want to listen to what the vice president had to say about the strike on Soleimani. Now, if you haven't heard, I mean, I know you listeners, you're well aware now of the strike on Qasem Soleimani at the Baghdad airport that happened at the authorization of the president. But what we're learning behind the scenes is that the justification is largely that there were imminent strikes planned by Soleimani, that he was in Baghdad to try to plan these strikes against American forces, American embassies. There is not, that we know of, any evidence of that has been shared publicly. The defense secretary has said that he has not seen evidence of that, but he trusts the president that evidence exists. And that Vice President Pence has said the following. You're going to hear him talking on Fox News with Brian Kilmeade, why that there really was no need to share this information in advance, ask for congressional approval, or at least even call people like Nancy Pelosi and other leaders in Congress. Some of the president's allies have said, well, we couldn't have trusted them with this information anyway. Well, here's what the vice president told Fox News.
Let me assure your viewers, I was there every step of the way. And while to protect sources and methods, we're simply not able to share with every member of the House and Senate the intelligence that supported the president's decision to take out Qasem Soleimani, I can assure your viewers that there was a threat of an imminent attack. It was after those airstrikes the president ordered on those five militia bases that we began to receive word that Soleimani was traveling the region to make preparations for a larger attack on American forces and American personnel. It was real-time information that was developed. Right. The leadership in Congress, in the House and Senate, has seen this intelligence. And frankly, the most compelling intelligence to support the fact that there was an imminent attack being developed by Qasem Soleimani is, frankly, too sensitive to share broadly. It would compromise what we call sources and methods. But I want your viewers to understand that that information was brought to the president, and I couldn't be more proud to serve alongside a president when faced with intelligence that Qasem Soleimani was preparing to launch attacks against American military and civilian personnel. Right. President Donald Trump acted. He took him out. Then we took measures necessary to protect our forces in the region, even after an Iranian missile strike. No right. casualties, and Iran is standing down.
That's Vice President Mike Pence. Do you want to respond to some of what you heard there?
Well, I think it's a fairly normal response from an executive administration to say, you know, we just can't engage with the legislative branch and they aren't going to keep our secrets. On top of that, he said they had the information, so he's kind of a bit confused as to how it is that he's presenting what happened. I think there's also an effort on most parts of most administrations to say we had to act, right? And so it's something like, you know, yelling, he has a gun, as you're running into the room to stop the person, only to realize it was a lighter. And that's a fairly consistent thing that we see over several administrations. So it's not unique to Republicans or Democrats, for that matter. And you'll see the same sort of thing with the idea that if not for them, you know, American lives would be lost, and so therefore they were compelled to act. There was no possibility of them doing otherwise. But at the same time, they were measured and careful and calm in how it is that they decided to make the decision, which can't be contained in one person or one head, right? So these are kinds of things where they sort of throw up smoke screens to stop us from really understanding what happened, because we hear American deaths, imminent threat, national security, and most people are sufficiently placated by those terms. And then on top of that, we don't have a legislative branch that says, actually, was there imminent threats? You know, if there wasn't, how are we holding you accountable? So all of that allows executives for, I'd say, about 40 years to say all these things and keep the power for themselves.
So to the point of Professor Burns, the response from Vice President Pence was not all that surprising or unique anymore.
Correct.
And by the way, unique can't be qualified. I take that point. But it wasn't that much different than what we would seen from previous administrations in both major parties that have held power. But let me ask you going forward, should we as a people, forget Congress, should we accept when our leadership to explain a strike, a military strike, says, uses the phrase like, let me assure you that we had the information, then says we can't give you the information because it's too sensitive to share. Should that be acceptable anymore?
I think it's really important for the American people to start remembering that we actually don't want the government carrying out secret missions all over the world for secret reasons by, you know, secret men and women who have been given the order by who knows who. And the longer we allow for that and just say that that's something that's an acceptable part of how it is that America conducts foreign policy, the more it's going to get us into farther and farther trouble. Because there's going to be people like Soleimani who are important to their people and important to a foreign government that's not friendly to the United States, which is going to cause more serious backlashes than just hitting the base and then the very tragic death of several hundred people on the Ukrainian flight, right? That's a smaller problem, but we're at a stage in the world of rebalancing where you could very easily see a sort of World War One scenario where one terrorist hurts one individual and all of a sudden the entire world is on fire.
Sure. There was not, it wasn't just Republican senators. There were Democratic senators responding to the Iranian missile strike on the Iraqi base that housed some Americans. Clearly, at this point, that was a show of strength from Tehran that was not designed to cause casualties in response to the strike against Soleimani because nobody died. They were. It's pretty clear that's what they were doing. But as this was happening, one of the Democratic senators said, you know, if Americans die in this strike, I can't see how we don't hit them back harder. I mean, that's how fast we could have seen escalation happening here.
Yes. And it's also, you know, imagine if there had been an American on the Ukrainian flight or if there had been an American who was accidentally near a sensitive Iranian base or something that they say about this attack. You know, we could have seen escalation on top of that. Because what is unique to this administration is I'll say that there's a much more confused chain of command. And so where Obama, talking about the Libyan strike, because I know that one fairly well, released a letter 2 days after initiating strikes to Congress and the people, gave a talk about it and explained what it was that was happening. Everyone understood who was in charge and what it was that we were doing. Now, there were still all sorts of smoke screens around that of national security and regional stability, which we can get into. But it was very clear to everyone in the military and likely everyone then on the other side who was in charge and what we were doing and where we were doing it. So conversely, with the Trump administration, you had that strange letter saying that the Americans are pulling out of Iraq that wasn't supposed to go out. And you have Mike Pompeo and Mark Esper and Trump all kind of contradicting each other on the imminence of the threat or the importance of the imminence of the threat. And so that makes it so that people at the lower levels of the military aren't quite sure where they're supposed to go or what they're supposed to do. And when you have that kind of confusion, then the kinds of things like the what happened with the Iranians shooting down an airline flight, that kind of thing can happen. So it could have very easily been that the United States was the one who accidentally did something like that to the Iranians instead of vice versa.
Okay, last question before we get to listener feedback. What should Congress's role or at least involvement have been during the Iran situation?
Well, I think we're seeing Congress trying to assert itself a little bit more. And we've seen under Trump I don't want to give it a number, but a more serious effort on the part of Congress to really stand up to the presidency and tell him, you know, there are certain lines you won't cross. So I think what we should have seen here is much more clear bipartisan support for Congress asserting its war powers. And the House has already passed something like that. It's possible we'll see something like that in the Senate. You know, Tim Kaine and Mike Reed and Rand Paul are all trying. So if they get that pass and if they get a more aggressive assertion of their war powers and a more aggressive assertion of holding the president accountable, that would be what they should be doing.
The challenge would be the next Democratic president would have to respect it if this passes. Are you concerned, or at least does history tell us that that would be in jeopardy the next time a Democrat is in the White House?
I think there isn't any more restraint on Democrats than there are on Republicans. And so therefore, if there's some sort of reason why a Democrat would want to be very aggressive or very erratic in their actions, as we've seen with Trump on occasion, there's nothing restraining them from doing so.
But in other words, to the extent you want to finish the idea of whether we're on the Rome track, your book leaves me as a reader with the sense that we still have agency to change course, to understand this, to recalibrate what the balance looks like. It is not inevitable one way or another. Is that fair?
Yes, I totally agree that what we need from Congress is more assertion in order to demonstrate that we've had an imbalance for a time, but we can rebalance that. And that's a totally normal part of a regime's evolution, is you have, you know, concentration in power in one branch and concentration in power in another. You see the legislative branch being very, very assertive after the Civil War, to the point where Woodrow Wilson said the problem that we have in the United States is Congress is too powerful, right? And so we can't even fathom that at this point. But that's the kind of rebalancing that we need, is a more aggressive Congress, perhaps even too aggressive, in order to balance out the executive branch.
Jane in Rochester first on the phone. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, I feel like Democrats should have made more noise and stood up, even if they lost the battle against Trump on this issue, on the way we're interpreting it. But it's already been called an assassination, and that raises its level of importance in my mind. And it sets a precedent. Will he do it again? Will Trump do something like that again? Or will foreign countries say, those in the United States are fair game, important politicos or whoever. And then we're dealing with a powder keg over there. And very scary, what was just mentioned, the possibility of escalation. So those are some of my reasons why I think the Congress should have just raised hell over this already. But thank you very much.
Jane, thank you. What do you make of that, Professor?
Yeah, I think you're right that Democrats really should have been pushing very hard. What I would have liked to have seen that might seem a bit of a unicorn by 2020 is bipartisan cooperation in an effort to try and make sure that it wasn't just Democrats pushing back against the Republican president. So you could say, no, we as a branch do not think that you should be doing this. We've seen a few of these instances previously. The other thing that's very telling in this instance is you're right that people are calling it an assassination. And that's when we get into this confusing world of legalese that makes everything very difficult, because Trump is claiming that the 2002 AUMF that launched the Iraq War, so that's the authorization for the use of military force to go into Iraq, he's claiming that covers his action against Soleimani, because Soleimani was in Iraq and engaged in an effort to do something in Iraq. And so therefore, this 18-year-old AUMF somehow covers the actions here. Furthermore, you see Iran, which is an illiberal country, claiming that they have the right under the UN, Article 51, to self-defense, right? So they were retaliating against the US out of self-defense. And when they can credibly say that as an illiberal country, we have a problem, because we don't look like the moral agents that, again, we would like to think of ourselves as. And that makes it a lot easier for other countries to do these kinds of things. Another good example, or a good, bad example, an example of the problem here is when Putin went into Crimea in Ukraine, he said he was engaged in a humanitarian intervention. And so he had to go and help and save the people of Russian descent in Ukraine because they were being persecuted. And so once we allow that kind of language that should be used to impede genocide and horrible leaders doing horrible things to their people, and once we allow it to be used in these kinds of manipulative ways, the language loses its moral quality and moral capacity to help us do the right thing in the world.
All right. Hal in Danville, next on the phone. Go ahead, Hal.
Thank you. Two points I was hoping to make. Thank you very much. This is a wonderful discussion and very thoughtful. One is based on a book by the historian Gary Wills, Bomb Power, The Modern Presidency and the National Security State, published in 2010. And he basically argues that the modern presidents and their candidates, because of the Manhattan Project and the secrecy associated with it, and then with the nuclear triad and split-second decision-making, led to a secretive apparatus of the so-called national security state, including agencies like the CIA, which our Senator Moynihan wanted to undo, as I recollect, and the NSA, and leaves war-making and the apparatus costing trillions, unaccountable to Congress and the American people. And the second point was the AUMF and the Patriot Act after 9/11 led to a blank check where trillions have been spent, literally, as well as an open door for presidents to essentially become Caesar-like in a world with air power and now a space command. So I wonder what your outstanding guest thinks about the role of nuclear weapons in giving the presidency unitary power, and secondly, what she thinks about the cacophony of essentially the end of print journalism, where we now have, we don't really have thoughtful, reflective print journalism, unlike this show, which I find very thoughtful.
Okay. Hal, thank you. Go ahead, Professor.
Thank you very much. Those are important questions. I think on the question of secrecy, it's certainly true that it seemed like an imperative at the time. And so I don't mean to always be so sympathetic to the Cold War era, but you know, my parents tell me of being told to sit under their desk because there might be a nuclear winter coming, and somehow them, you know, being under a desk is going to stop them from being annihilated by this horrifying weapon. So when you are thinking through protecting an entire country from literally annihilation, you can be understanding, I think, more about why it is that they decided to have all the secrecy and have all the spying, because you really didn't want to have the Cold War become hot between the US and the Soviets. So spying became a really important part of that. All the same, you should have had some kind of congressional checks and a little bit more emphasis in the Cold War on Congress ensuring that all of the CIA's activities are being monitored by someone besides the executive branch. And nuclear weapons are also then a part of that because of, like I said, everyone was worried about literal annihilation or the destruction of the world several times over. And so that's why it is that they started giving such a broad grant, which then they just didn't recover the institutional memory that they needed to in the 1990s. And so by the time you then get to 9/11 and this new fear, essentially what happens with 9/11 is you have the war on terror replacing the Manichaean or black and white worldview where we're good, communists are bad, and now we're good, radical Islamists are bad. And so we have to fight them with the same tools and same weapons that we used in the Cold War. And so that's when you get this really bad break, because you don't need to fight radical Islam the way that you fight the Soviets. They aren't nearly as powerful, and we can see that in the techniques that they use in order to combat us. So once we have the mindset of Congress sort of ceding its powers and the president just doing what it wants, we can't seem to unring that bell very effectively. So we need a bit of a cooling period so Congress can start to say, we have to reassert our powers. And so, as I said, somewhat hopefully, it might be that in the Trump era, that's what we see, is Congress really starting to push back as a branch.
Forgive me for doing this, but in our last 90 seconds,
Okay. Share
with listeners your concerns about what happens if there isn't a rebalancing of war powers.
I think if there isn't a rebalancing of war powers, what we're going to end up seeing is more bumbling wars like we've seen over the past 20 years and arguably the big interventions that we've seen previously, so Vietnam and Korea. Because part of what we have is a lack of deliberation. So it's not just a lack of deliberation between the executive and legislative branches. It's also a lack of deliberation in the executive branch. And without really challenging your ideas, without putting your ideas against grand strategy and what's in the broader interest of the United States, it's very hard to really achieve meaningful goals in an effective way. And we see this in the Afghan papers, where it's true that, you know, Bush didn't do very well in Afghanistan, but Obama had similarly poorly thought through policies. And that's, again, because there just isn't this focus on ensuring that the way that we do things is through thinking through what we want, thinking through our grander objectives, and putting those two things together effectively. And so as long as we don't have any kind of real deliberation, especially even within the executive branch, we're never going to recover an effective grand strategy.
20 seconds. Sometimes when we have a catastrophic moment, you think you're going to get a recalibration. Are we learning lessons from history, or do you see us tending to ignore them?
I think that we are learning some lessons from history, but we're not learning them effectively enough or quickly enough. And so what we need to do is really have a better sense of, one, how little we have to worry about things like radical Islam, and how much we had to worry about something like communism.
The book is available now. It's just out. The Politics of War Powers, The Theory and History of Presidential Unilateralism, a monumental achievement from Sarah Burns, RIT political science professor. I hope you'll return and engage with us and our listeners some more, because unfortunately many of these questions are not going away in our lifetime. So please come back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You got it. The book is available now. More connections coming up.